What was it like to be a part of the events that shaped our world? This is the show that shares those stories from the people who were there. This is Eyewitness History. Hello, and thank you for joining the show today. My name is Jeremy Stonelecker. I am your host. And today we are going to get an eyewitness perspective on an event that a lot of us are familiar with. This is one of those that I'm sure there are people in the audience who maybe even participated in. Certainly a lot of us can remember this happening, but getting the perspective of those on the ground. Today we're going to talk about the Gulf War in 1990-1991. This is sometimes confused with what began in Iraq in 2003. But this is the Gulf War. This is what was later called Desert Storm. Before that, kind of the blocking or the defensive action was called Desert Shield. And that was before the storm. There was the shield. And so that took place as well. An amazing, amazing event. And it's crazy because when I think of that, I was a younger teenager as those events unfolded. People talk about it being the 100-hour war and being an uber successful military engagement and the way things played out. And certainly it was, but you lose sight of those who were on the ground. But I think back to those times, and I think about all that went into that, and even reading about the lead up to the war and Saddam Hussein leading his military, the Iraqis, to go into and seize Kuwait and try to annex Kuwait. And some of the reason for that was oil, and some of the reason for that was money. And there were other reasons connected to it. It's not entirely clear what exactly pushed him to take that action, but certainly he did. And I know a lot of folks have talked about it and written about it. But the end result of that was a multinational coalition came together, and that was led by Storman Norman Schwarzkopf, the general who was in charge, United States Army general who was in charge of that. And again, so many other, you know, big personalities and folks that we would all be familiar with, leading that coalition, eventually pushing the Iraqi army out of Kuwait and restoring that country to the government that had been in exile, the Kuwaiti government that had been in exile. Just an amazing story, amazing, amazing story. That was really, in a real sense, the first time that live reporting was done in a combat environment, in a conflict like that, you know, for generations going back, I guess probably to the beginning, the earliest reporters, right? We're reporting on what was happening in war and different things that were happening. But this was live reporting. CNN had reporters there. I remember listening to Wolf Blitzer give live reports of what was happening there. And so a lot of things changed. This kind of brought warfare into the modern era, if you will. And a lot of things changed. But what didn't change is that at the end of the day in every conflict, it is the boots on the ground. It is the warrior who's on the ground, either pushing back or defending against the enemy. And that's exactly what happened. I'm grateful to have on today a very close friend of mine. John Folberg is with us. And as I was thinking about, you know, these shows and a lot of the events that took place, of course, I started by looking into the group of folks that I know. And John and I have been friends for a number of years. And we've worked together in a number of ways. He served with us in the work that I do with the Mighty Oaks Foundation, working with veterans and service members. He has been a friend. He's been a mentor to me. We're very close to his family. And so I was thinking about these shows, and I've heard John talk about leading a Marine infantry company into Kuwait and in the early moments, the opening moments of the Gulf War in Desert Storm, being a part of that. So I asked him to come on and talk about that, and he graciously did. And man, the firsthand account, I love this show for this reason. The firsthand account, folks who were there, politics aside, the big, what we know of from television and the news aside, folks who were on the ground watching it happen, living through it, dealing with kind of the fallout of it, and all that goes into that. And so I'm very grateful that John would come on and talk to us today. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with my friend, John Folberg.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
John, thank you for joining me.
Hey, well, thank you for the invite, Jeremy. I sure appreciate it. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, I think I told you I would be happy to talk about anything. So this just gave us a reason to get together and talk. So I'm happy about it. We're going to talk about the Gulf War, and you know, there's a lot wrapped up in that. But for those that don't know you, which listening would probably be most people, talk about your military history and maybe talk about your whole career. And then we'll come back to where you were as a company commander before all this kicked off.
You bet. So my military career, so to speak, actually began right out of high school. I joined the Army, enlisted in the Army, was ultimately sent to the prep school for West Point, and then went to West Point, where I distinguished myself by flunking out during my sophomore year. And the academic department basically said, you know, Cadet Folberg, we think you'd be good somewhere else, anywhere else. So I ultimately transferred out to a school in Colorado, a place called Western State, where I skied either 2 or 3 days a week during the winter ski season and went to school the other 2 or 3 days. So my college experience was really enjoyable beginning my sophomore year. Not so much for school.
As long as you had fun.
yeah, I sure did. And that's where I got involved in the Marine Corps' PLC program. And it was not a plan that I'd join the Marine Corps and make it a career. Actually, I just needed a ride to Denver. And the officer selection officer offered me a ride. He'd fly me to Denver from Gunnison. Put me up in a hotel, feed me, and that sounded great as long as I took his physical exam and took the ASVAB. And I could do that, so I did. Ultimately, I went to OCS that next summer between my junior and senior year, and then finished that. That was the 10-week program. And then when I graduated from college, I was looking at a variety of different options, and I just thought, well, the Marine Corps will be a good 3-year experience, and then I'll move on to something else. And got to the basic school. I'd always wanted to be an infantry guy. My dad was. My dad was in the Army, and he was an airborne ranger, had a couple of combat deployments, one to Korea, one in Vietnam. And so basically, I thought, well, I'll do the Marine Corps, and then maybe I'll go back into the Army where I first started. But within about a year of being in the Marine Corps sent me to Ranger School, which was a great experience. Not necessarily a fun experience, but it was a really good experience, challenging. And so within about a year, I had drunk the Marine Corps Kool-Aid and wasn't going to go into the Army from there. And then just did normal deployments that the Marine Corps was doing, UDP, unit deployment programs. My first duty assignment was over to Okinawa to be part of 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines. And I was a rifle platoon commander, then a weapons platoon commander, Company XO, and then I took over that company. And that was back in 81, 82. We came back to the U.S. and then did I did a deployment down in South America, a UNITAS deployment. And then from there, I spent 39 months on recruiting duty, and that was not what I wanted to do in the Marine Corps at all. I actually submitted my resignation, but the Marine Corps said I hadn't paid back my commitment for being augmented into the regular Marine Corps from the reserves. Most lieutenants who came in were in the reserves, only about 10% who came in. So you had to go through the augmentation process. So I had payback for that. And by the time that was done, I'd been selected for AWS. And so decided to stick around, went to AWS. From AWS, I had a really interesting assignment that I was part of the United Nations observer group in southern Lebanon. And then over in Egypt. And so in southern Lebanon, we were on the basically the border between Israel and Lebanon, where some of that activity is going on now. My boss, right before I got there, had been kidnapped by the Hezbollah. He was ultimately tortured and murdered, Colonel Rich Higgins. Wow. And then but that was just really interesting to watch the insurgency between the Hezbollah, the Amal, and the Israeli forces that would regularly go up into Lebanon and do their armored patrols or do their airstrikes. And then the second 6 months of that assignment, I was out in the Sinai. And what was really interesting about that was the only place that I know of in the world where an American officer and a Soviet officer would go out for a week, and it would just be the two of us out on an observation post. And the war wreckage from the battles that happened in the Sinai Desert were still there. So we talked tactics, we talked weapons, we talked economic systems. And it was just a really interesting 6 months to be able to have that kind of interaction with someone who we considered the enemy. That was still during the Cold War. Then came back from that assignment, and that's when I was assigned to 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines out in 29 Palms. And that's where I became a rifle company commander again. And that's probably what we'll talk about. But following that assignment, I did about 2 years at 8th and I as a parade commander and working at MCI as the department chief for the course developers. Got my master's degree up at the Naval Command and Staff College up in Newport, Rhode Island. Then from there, did 1 year language school to learn Greek. One of the classes I flunked at West Point was Spanish. And so when it came time for my assignment...
They said, go learn Greek.
Yeah, the Marine Corps decided to send me to DLI to learn Greek. And so... that's what I suffered through for a year. And the only way I passed is because DLI had a crazy bell curve grading system where you can still miss at least half the questions and get a C. So that's how I did not flunk out of that school. And then I spent 2 years over in Greece as the unconventional warfare officer working with the Greek military and some anti-terrorism force protection stuff. And then from there, I went to my last assignment, which was Marine Corps Support Activity out of Kansas City. And then retired in 2001, became a horseshoer, loved that, but was trying to get back because 2001, as you know, things started heating up. And ultimately, I took a position as a team leader of a human train team that took me to Afghanistan. And then I took a position as a team leader for another kind of cultural population-focused team down in the southern half of Iraq, and that took me to Iraq for a year. And kind of the rest is kind of history.
What a career! Yeah, what a career! It's crazy because you saw history, right? It repeats itself, and so all of the things we're talking about right now, you have been to all of those places, and we're dealing with a lot of the same kind of issues we're dealing with today, I guess. I saw those firsthand, which is pretty crazy. Yeah, it's crazy to think we've already been here and we're doing it again.
Yeah. So it was a wonderful sure. But.
When I think of Desert Storm, and I think of, you know, the Gulf War and everything that happened there, I was a young teenager. And so I remember all of it happening, watching the news reports, listening to Wolf Blitzer, I think was the CNN guy who was there and was giving all the reports and all of the things that happened. And since then, I've talked to a lot of people, you know, yourself and many other people who have talked about being there and everything that kind of led up to it. But can you talk for a minute about kind of the lead up to it? I think this is one thing people don't really understand, is that most of the American troops that deployed, I guess it would be Desert Shield, the first part of kind of that, you know, whatever that was, that deployment, most of those didn't actually end up in combat. And I don't think, like, those were two very distinct activities. I don't think we always put all of that together. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the buildup and getting there and the Desert Shield versus what would become, you know, Desert Storm?
Yeah, so ours was a little different than the normal unit that was part of those units that were during the buildup, during Desert Shield. We were on a unit deployment program, and we were in the Philippines. We were basically there as a stabilization force because of the activities in the Philippines, trying to be an American flag to support the Filipino government and to prevent insurgencies from, or a coup from happening. So we were there until November. Then we got retasked, went back to Okinawa, rearmed, refit, and then they sent us to Saudi Arabia to be part of Desert Shield. So we weren't part of that buildup in Saudi Arabia from August until when the ground war started. We arrived there right towards the end of Desert Shield. But we knew our mission pretty quickly once we were retasked. We were going to be an infiltration force, foot mobile, and we were going to infiltrate into Kuwait. And so that's where we focused our training as soon as we arrived in country. And we were already, when we were doing our stuff in the Philippines, we were foot mobile there too. We were doing a lot of patrolling, a lot of that kind of activity, although it was in a jungle environment, very different than Kuwait. Yeah. But it was all foot mobile. So we had the conditioning, if you want to say, but not the conditioning for the weight and the loads that we were going to be carrying. That came as a surprise as you transition a peacetime force to a wartime force.
You're a company commander going into that. And, you know, people talk about the burden of command or whatever. It's a hard thing, I know, to communicate to people as an infantry Marine, particularly. This is what you train for. This is what you prepare for. But there is a huge buildup. You guys are getting there. Your unit is getting there toward the end of, you know, that. Getting ready to do this movement. What are you thinking as you consider leading Marines into an environment like that?
I think it'd probably be focused in two directions. One, I wanted the decisions that I'd make to be decisions that would be the right decisions, the correct tactical decisions that would not only accomplish the mission, but also take care of the Marines that I was responsible for. So that was one aspect. That was kind of the burden, but that was the introspective. You know, you got to be making the right calls, John. Unfortunately, the the platoon commanders, the staff NCOs, the NCOs were outstanding. And we had been together for, at that point, almost 2 years. We were a pretty stable force. So we knew each other well, and we knew how each other operated, thought. The other is communicating with the Marines in the sense that I wanted them to be confident in our capabilities. And then what they had been trained to do, I wanted them to feel assured that, yep, this is going to be a hard mission, infiltrating across a tabletop flat terrain with no cover concealment, with the closest armored reinforcements, probably 10, 15 miles behind us. That was going to be a difficult mission, but they could do it. And so I don't know if that really answers your question. So one was right decision-making on my behalf, supported by the platoon commanders and staff NCOs, and then confidence, we got this, to the Marines.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when I was in Iraq, you know, when we got the call to go, and I've been asked this question a lot, what are you thinking when you get the call to move into combat or whatever? And I mean, I'm not that smart. So, I mean, I wasn't thinking much. I was thinking, well, finally we get to go do what we came here to do. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But sometimes it's almost looking back. I wonder, you know, maybe I should have had better thoughts or clearer thoughts or whatever, but there is something about your training and about being with those Marines for that period of time. And you just trust that you can do the work. And it's again, it's very hard to explain. And I think even to understand, but, there's a job to be done and we're ready to do it. And we've trained and prepared to be a part of whatever's going to happen next.
Yeah. And you remember that you're part of something bigger, and you know, I guess the footprints of the Marines who have preceded us were following those boot prints. I don't think I ever said it that way, but I know that that's part of the tradition within the Marine Corps, old Corps, new Corps kind of thing. We're all the same Corps. So,
yeah, that's good. So talk about how that unfolded then, you know, the order to move and then that engagement. And it really is, I've heard you talk about it before. It's very hard to picture and really fairly unconventional. Can you just kind of walk us through that?
Yeah, so we had been, the point I made a second ago, we were a peacetime force that was now in a combat situation. So we had a generation of Marines, at least up until probably the colonel level. So from second lieutenant to colonel with virtually no combat experience. So we were learning by doing and doing a lot of mistakes. Some of the buildup, you know, we got equipment that we'd never trained with, GPS. We'd never used one, seen one, and we got handed GPSs like 45 minutes before we crossed the line of departure to begin the infiltration. My regimental commander was relieved about 10 days before we crossed the line of departure for basic incompetence. And the guy who took over his job was the division operations officer, who happened to be my OSO way back in college days.
the guy who talked you into getting on that, that plane.
and he was a good man. He knew the plan. And in fact, his plan of the infiltration, that was his idea into this thing. So I mentioned, you know, what you communicate with the troops. We can do this. In my mind, I'm thinking, this is not how you conduct an infiltration, because what we ended up doing is basically we had our stay elements out in front, the surveillance target acquisition teams out in front of the battalion. We had some of our gun trucks, the Humvees with 50s and Mark 19s on our flanks. and we were in a column of twos, and we just moved north for about 15 miles. The loads we were carrying were in excess of 100 pounds. And as much as I tried to load up my Marines during training, before this, we never reached that 100-pound capability or 100-pound measure. So that was eye-opening for us. But we got to within about 5 clicks of the first minefield. Actually, let me back up. We got to what's called the berm, which was the basically the border between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And we established a holding position there while all the other units were moving around the battlefield, just getting into position. And then on 3 days before the ground war, G-3, we got the move word to move out, and that's when we moved another 15 miles inside of Kuwait and established another defensive position, this time within sight of that first minefield. And, you know, once again, just remembering that very flat terrain. So we moved very little during the day just maybe shuffled our positions a little bit to make them more defensible at night. And then on D-1, our stay elements found a small lane through the first minefield. In fact, they found it because they saw Iraqi soldiers coming through the minefield, and they just retraced their steps through that minefield. Got into a little bit of a fight, and we got the call. We being my company, our company, got the call to move up immediately and to assume a breachhead position in that minefield. And this was still probably 12 hours plus before the authorized go time for D-Day. And so our battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Tim Hannigan, asked if he could move the battalion up to secure this breachhead. He was told, no, can't do anything that you can't undo. And so our company stayed up in that position for about 6 more hours until finally permission was given for the battalion to come up and reinforce us. We were told we had a couple of reinforced Iraqi companies coming down from each flank. That never really materialized. Some soldiers surrendered. But the on that movement north, we got word, move up to the first minefield. And so now we're standing up. We can easily be seen. And we got hit with some artillery. And those were our first casualties. 3 Marines, our lead element, had 3 Marines who were wounded. Just right off the bat, I mean, 5 minutes into this thing. And fortunately, we got the medevaced out. And what was interesting is, you know, that training that you were talking about and how that just kicks in. And I mentioned I'd gone to Ranger School. And this was it now. Ranger School was 10 years before this. But during Ranger School, one of the things you always rehearsed was actions of the objective and then your immediate actions. One of those immediate actions drills that we always rehearsed before every patrol was, what do you do when you get hit with artillery? Well, I hadn't practiced that at all in 10 years. Wow. We didn't, you know, really, even when we were in the field, we didn't practice IA drills associated with artillery fire. But what we learned at Ranger School kicked in, and that's what we did. You know, we shifted to the left about 100 meters and then continued the attack. And that got us out of because the Iraqis were poor with deflection changes on their artillery. And
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was just an immediate response. I hadn't thought about it. You know, it was just one of those things. Thank you, Lord, for recollection. And so we got into that first minefield, held that. I say held it. There was no one shooting at us. A bunker was blowing up that the Iraqis had set fire to before they surrendered. And then as the battalion came up, we held our position. try and move through our position. And then we followed in trace. And the lead element of the battalion at that point ran into a second minefield that we didn't know about. And so had to work our way through that minefield. And now it's G-Day, or actually D-Day. And so we were part of Task Force Grizzly. That was our task force. Task Force Ripper was the main effort. They were the mechanized element. And so now they're coming through the lanes that we had established. And one of the elements in their task force saw dismounted troops up on the horizon and assumed they were Iraqis and just started firing it up. Well, those troops on the horizon were us. And that's when we took friendly fire, and one of our Marines, Christian Porter, who was driving a 5-ton with all of our gear in it, sleeping bags, that sort of stuff. He got killed instantly. But we just pressed on the rest of that day, got to our objective that night with no further casualties. And so we spent the night there. The next day we loaded up in trucks, came back, went through the minefield up to Jabber, which was the objective for Ripper for that day. We relieved Ripper. They went on to Kuwait International Airport, and we were beginning the attack on El Jabber Air Base when our company got hit with rocket fire and had a Marine killed. He didn't die immediately. He bled out, and it was really painful for him. And we had 5 more wounded. And the oil fires that had been set, the wind shifted direction, and so now it blew that cloud, that black oil cloud, over top of us. And this was around 1700 in the evening. It quickly was, well, with that oil cloud, it was dark. And then with the night coming, it just became pitch black. So the decision to hold the attack until the next day, and the next day came. We moved into Jabber, and it was an abandoned airstrip. There was nobody there. Took some POWs, but that was it, EPWs. And that was it. And that's where we spent the next, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 days. And then wrapped things up and came home.
Yeah.
So,
what a crazy, crazy time. And I think going from, you know, like you said, from a peacetime to a wartime, or, you know, into combat. The United States has been at war for a long time now, and we have a lot of combat veterans, even though some of that has changed recently. But when we went into Iraq, it was the same thing. I think we had, you know, maybe a sergeant major in our regiment who had been a part of maybe Desert Storm or something. But I mean, we didn't have anyone who had ever experienced combat. And so it changes everything. But then to lose Marines and to deal with casualties, it's one thing to talk about it and to even, you know, rehearse casualty plans and all of the rest of it. But I can imagine, you know, in all of the things that you had to deal with, and particularly even the friendly fire incident, that had to have been the most difficult as a company commander, is dealing with wounded and killed Marines.
Yeah, it was. That was the thing that for me to say that was the most difficult. That was the thing that really I brought a lot of anger and bitterness home with me. And that was one of the things. Our medevac plan to get wounded Marines off the battlefield was basically mark them with an 8-digit grid and leave them there. We didn't have Arab medevacs. We only had ground medevacs. And so getting Brian Lane, who died under that rocket fire, out took probably an hour and a half to get a ground medevac to him. And by the time it came, he was dead. And so it was just like, And in the middle of all of that, also, we got hit with what we thought was a chemical attack. So now we're in MOP 4 and, you know, trying to take care of casualties while we're in that condition, getting them into a MOP suit. And, well, they're already in a MOP suit. We did that in the middle of a minefield. But it was just, not real good.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Do you think that, you know, we've always done a lot of things wrong as a military, particularly as a Marine Corps, right? We like to learn the hard way, but that is one area. I think the casualty collection area and evacuation of wounded. Again, just speaking from my own experience, 20 years later in Iraq, 12 or 13 years later, when we were in Iraq, I mean, that we did right. We did a lot of things wrong, but that we did right. And I wonder how much of that was born from just the lessons learned in, you know, in that engagement in Desert Storm.
Yeah. I hope that there was some lesson learning going on there. But that was one of the things that when we came back from that experience, the battalion commander told us, even, I think before even we left theater, we're going to talk about some of this stuff. And we put together some, you know, lessons learned from that experience. And for me, there were a number of lessons learned, but that was certainly one of them. And the training, you know.
Yeah, it's funny. Crazy.
Just the training, how heavy we were. I mean, the guys who were carrying the Dragons, they were using push carts, handmade wooden push carts to carry their Dragons. We looked like the Roman soldiers crossing this desert. So.
Isn't it funny that when people talk about Desert Storm, I mean, it's talked about in, you know, it was a 100-hour war. It was a resounding success. It was this amazing military feat, and then when you're on the ground, you're pushing carts and carrying over 100 pounds of gear and equipment and trying to figure out how to medevac people in MOP 4 in a minefield. I mean, it's so crazy, the perspectives on that stuff. What are some of, you know, you've had a lot of time to reflect and look back. What are some of the lessons that you personally have taken from that experience and maybe even took into the rest of your career?
I think those things have been evolving over time. The first was, if you're going to lead men in combat, because that's all we had at that particular time was men in combat. Now we have both men and women. But if you're going to lead Marines in combat, Marines and corpsmen, you'd better be competent. So I came back with a chip on my shoulder that if I thought you were incompetent, I was going to do whatever I could to get you out of the Marine Corps, at least out of the O3 MOS. You do not belong in front of troops in combat. And so that was one of the things I brought back. And I don't think I did that really well. I was just angry, and that anger was just in kind of blast mode for a while. I think another bad thing I learned was, or when I say bad, I say wrong, is relationships. When we lost Brian and Christian and had the seven other Marines wounded, as a result of that, I knew we were going to take casualties, but then actually having casualties and seeing what they were going through, and that was hard for me to deal with, in the sense of, it's my responsibility to lead these men, to take care of these men, and now they're being hurt and killed. And so the bad lesson learned was, I'm not going to be close to anybody. I'll put up this wall, so to speak, and not let personal relationships enter into my, you know, leading and leadership philosophy, if you will. And I actually got called out on that by a staff NCO when I was at 8th and I. I was the department head of these course developers for the Marine Corps, for MCI courses that I don't think they exist anymore. But the and so we had, this section had 52 of probably some of the best and brightest NCOs the Marine Corps has to offer who can actually write an MCI course on their particular MOS. And I remember this, he was actually a gunnery sergeant, came in, hey, Major, can I talk to you? Sure. And he wanted to know why I was so distant. And I really had to come to grips with, why was I distancing myself from, you know, the men and women in this department who I had such respect for? And I had no, I explained to him my logic, and he just, he looked at me like the village idiot, which I should have been looked at that way. But it was just like, yeah, you know, if being a Marine is about anything, it's about the relationships you build with the Marines on your left and right flank, the Marines that you're with. So those were two bad lessons learned. But then as time has moved forward, I think those hard-nosed perspectives softened a little bit and opened me up to a much more empathetic and compassionate view of some of the frailties, weaknesses, or blind spots that people might have. That's still a work in progress, particularly as Carrie, as you know, my bride, she and I work with abuse victims. I'm more with perpetrators than the victims. But just having that empathy and compassion. And I would also say, train as hard as you can possibly train. You know, do hard things. Be willing to be uncomfortable. And I still believe that. You know, don't come complaining because of training. Yeah, training. Okay, suck it up. Deal with it. Let's go. Come on, move on. We got to know how to deal with this, to operate in something like this. Whether it's in the Marine Corps or shoeing horses or, you know, hiking on a trail or just life in general. So that was, I think, a lesson learned that became cemented into my DNA. And you know, my girls, I've got three daughters, you know, they kind of grew up with the idea of, okay, take 500 milligrams of SIU, you know, 500 milligrams of suck it up. So,
oh man, what was it like going back to Iraq? You know, different conflict, different Marines, but going back into the country, did that impact you at all, or was it just kind of a different thing?
It was a really different thing. Because I didn't interact with Iraqis at all. You know, we had a couple of Kuwait officers who were attached to us. But it was interesting when it's interesting how when they find out that, when I say they, attachments, people who are not normally part of your unit, when they find out that you're going to be the main effort, the pointing into the spear, which we were, our company was the main effort for our battalion, they tend to disappear pretty quickly. But the only time it was poignant was I was in a Black Hawk coming from Basra back down to Kuwait. And as we crossed into Kuwait, heading towards where we flew out of, we were flying right over the areas that we had walked in Al Jaber, and I could see them from the aircraft. And that brought back some poignant memories. And with the desire of, man, I would love to go walk that terrain again, at least that area around Al Jaber and whatnot. The But yeah, they were so different between, you know, Desert Storm, which was, I don't want to offend any Marines out there, but we were a bunch of rookies trying to figure this out. To when I was in Iraq, okay, we'd been there for years at that point. That was 2010 and 2011. And holy cow, the military was doing and was capable of doing was like night and day, you know. It was incredibly different.
Yeah. So, and John, I appreciate you you sharing that story. I think most of the folks who would even reflect on Desert Storm and, you know, all of those big names, right? Colin Powell and Norman Schwarzkopf, and I mean, you know, Rumsfeld was involved in that. Like, we think about some of those people and some of those things. It's easy to get kind of this big view of what happened and not really connect to it. So thank you for sharing that the Marines who were there, the Marines who were hurt and lost their lives there. We need to tell stories like this so we don't forget. It's so important. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you would like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, visit ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts on the Parthenon Podcast Network. Thank you, and I will talk to you next time.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.